Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, February 26th. We'll play some excerpts now and get some thoughts on last night's Democratic debate with Washington Post columnist and editorial board member Jonathan Capehart, who also hosts their podcast Cape Up and is sometimes a WNYC host. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Great to be with you.
And obviously, the main plot line was Bernie Sanders attracting new attention as the front runner in delegates after the first three states. In this first clip we're going to play, Elizabeth Warren doesn't attack Sanders. She just asserts that she would make a better president.
Bernie and I both wanted to help rein in Wall Street. In 2008, we both got our chance. But I dug in, I fought the big banks, I built the coalitions, and I won. Bernie and I both want to see universal health care. But Bernie's plan doesn't explain how to get there, doesn't show how we're going to get enough allies into it, and doesn't show enough about how we're going to pay for it.
And of course, Senator Sanders disagreed with those criticisms. But what did you think of the line Elizabeth Warren was walking last night?
You know, it's the same line that she did, that she walked in the Las Vegas debate, which I find very curious. Throughout this campaign, both she and Senator Sanders have occupied the same space, as, you know, evidenced by that clip you played. They share a lot of the same positions. They just differ on how they get there. If she wants to be the nominee of the party, she has to take him down. She has to aggressively go after him. And she's not doing that. She didn't do it in Las Vegas. She didn't do it last night in Charleston, and I'm still trying to figure out what then is her purpose and her goal going forward in this nomination contest. I mean, part of me wonders if she's still playing it safe so that if at this point Bernie Sanders falters in getting the nomination and she's still standing, that his supporters will come to her. But as we get closer to Super Tuesday, that seems highly unlikely. And as we have also seen and read about in the press, and I've been a victim of it, as I'm sure a lot of journalists have, maybe even you have, Brian, that supporters of Bernie Sanders, particularly on social media, are rather vehement in their support of Senator Sanders. And so I wonder if for all of them up until this point, they decided not to try to lay a glove on Senator Sanders for fear of generating the hordes out there on social media that are literally take no prisoners.
Yeah, or Senator Warren is just saying what she really thinks because she doesn't want to attack Sanders for being a Democratic Socialist, I don't think. Maybe she just really believes what she said. She agrees with him on the large majority of issues. She just thinks she'd be a better president.
You know what? I agree with you. Maybe she does believe what she is saying. But I think at this point in the race, that tactic is a little too late. If any of them wants to be the Democratic nominee for president, they have to turn their attentions more aggressively towards Senator Sanders in order to slow his momentum. Mm-hmm. The approach she took last night is not slowing his momentum. It's walking hand in hand with him.
One of the main target audiences for last night's debate was black voters in South Carolina, nationally as well, but particularly in South Carolina, who will be an estimated 60-70% of the voters in the primary there this Saturday. Here's an example of how Pete Buttigieg tried to express his awareness of that context.
I'm conscious of the fact that there's 7 white people on this stage talking about racial justice. None of us have the experience, the lived experience of, for example, walking down the street or in a mall and feeling eyes on us, regarding us as dangerous without knowing the first thing about us just because of the color of our skin.
So Pete Buttigieg there. Here's an example of how Tom Steyer tried to court black voters.
I believe I'm the only person on this stage who believes in reparations for slavery. Something happened. We should have a formal commission on race to retell the story of the last 400 plus years in America of African Americans, of systematic legal injustice, discrimination, and cruelty, but also of 400 plus years of contribution in terms of building the United States of America and leading the United States of America from a moral standpoint.
Tom Steyer, and here's an example of how Joe Biden tried to court black voters.
When you get knocked down, get up, and everyone's entitled to be treated with dignity, no matter what, no matter who they are. My also that everyone should be represented. Everyone, no one's better than me, and I'm no better than anyone else. The fact is, what we should be doing, we talked about the Supreme Court. I'm looking forward to making sure there's a black woman on the Supreme Court to make sure we, in fact, get every representation.
So, Jonathan Capehart from The Washington Post, how would you begin to compare and contrast those three clips and those three candidates?
Well, let me start with Tom Steyer first. I'm actually talking to you from Columbia, South Carolina right now, where Tom Steyer has been on the ground and on the air for weeks, if not a couple of months now, looking to South Carolina to be a place where he could slow down Vice President Biden. I thought his talk about reparations, which is something he has been talking about consistently during this campaign, struck me as pandering. Super pandering, especially when you have him standing on stage with people like Mayor Pete, who actually has a plan out called the Douglas Plan, or even Mayor Bloomberg, who has his own plan called the Greenwood Initiative, all about seriously addressing the inequalities that have faced African Americans in this country since its inception. I'm not questioning Tom Steyer's sincerity. I believe he's sincere. I'm just not certain that it will attract enough votes for him to upset Vice President Biden. And speaking of Vice President Biden, of all those people on the stage, he's the one who has the biggest advantage. He is, according to the public opinion polls in the state, is leading, although by less than even a few months ago, I think Senator Sanders is within 5 points, right, percentage points of him in one of the polls I saw. But he is someone who is known to South Carolinians as, you know, former President Barack Obama's vice president. He's run for president twice before, so he's run here. African Americans know him. They're comfortable with him. And today, Vice President Biden earned Congressman Jim Clyburn's endorsement, which is a coveted endorsement by a person in this state who is hugely influential within the Democratic Party in South Carolina, but also among African Americans. He is the highest ranking African American in House leadership. So what Congressman Clyburn says carries a lot of weight. And as for Mayor Pete Buttigieg, what he said on that stage last night tracks with what he told me when I sat down with him for my podcast. I sat down with him on Monday in Charleston and interviewed him. And even then he said to me, and this is a direct quote, "Look, it's not lost on me that when there's a debate stage now, it's a bunch of white candidates sometimes talking about race in a way that I think all of us should pause and be humbled by," and then talked about the things that each of them brings is that, like, they want to get rid of Donald Trump, but recognizing the fact that nobody is feeling the pain of living under this administration more than black and Latino Americans. Mayor Pete, I've sat down with him three times. The first time in December 2018, before he was even a candidate. And he's been remarkably consistent in his views on all a host of issues, but also trying really hard to reach out to people of color, but particularly African Americans, and is having a time of it, and he recognizes it, which is why he put out that Douglas plan months ago, of course, named after Frederick Douglass. But I think part of his problem is you've got a former vice president who's very popular with African Americans and has been buoyed by that. You've got a billionaire in former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg, who's been blanketing the airwaves all over the country, and African American voters looking at him in a very pragmatic fashion, thinking, this is the guy, he's got deep pockets, and he's not afraid of Trump. Maybe he's the one to go for him. So those are my views on Mayor Pete Steyer and Biden.
And Bloomberg is up there now with Sanders and Biden in the top tier among African American voters in the latest Quinnipiac poll nationally. Here's Bloomberg making part of his general case, not race specific, after he gets criticized by Elizabeth Warren. Warren has just pointed out here that Bloomberg made campaign donations to Lindsey Graham in Graham's last reelection and to the Republican who ran against Warren herself in Massachusetts. So then she said,
"The core of the Democratic Party will never trust him. He has not earned their trust. I will. And the fact that he cannot earn the trust of the core of the Democratic Party means he is the riskiest candidate standing on this stage."
All right, Senator Warren, thank you. Mayor Bloomberg, would you like to respond?
I have been training for this job since I stepped on the pile that was still smoldering on 9/11. I know what to do. I've shown I know how to run a country. I've run the city, which is almost the same size, as bigger than most countries in the world. I am not the least, I'm the one choice that makes some sense. I have the experience, I have the resources, and I have the record. And all of the sideshows that the senator wants to bring up have nothing to do with that. When people hired me to run New York City three times in an overwhelmingly Democratic progressive city, they elected me again and again.
So he wrote off his donations to Lindsey Graham and Elizabeth Warren's opponent as sideshows. Jonathan, maybe with some disclosure on you working for Bloomberg a long time ago, but with that, what are you seeing with his unprecedented $500 million almost in campaign spending already, including all those confident-sounding TV commercials, and the contrast with his unsteadiness, or whatever word you want to use, in person in the debates?
Right. And I want to add to the disclosure, yes, that I worked on Mayor Bloomberg's first campaign for mayor in 2001, and my husband currently works on the presidential campaign. But having said that, I mean, his debate performance in Las Vegas was what I feared it would be, which is he is fantastic when it comes to the organizational, when it comes to the prepared and the packaged and putting forth his message in a way that he can control. But standing on that debate stage in Las Vegas, we saw a huge contrast. And part of it is understandable. He hadn't been on a debate stage in 10 years. He had never been on a presidential debate stage, which is unlike any debate stage anywhere in American politics. And so he's someone who is sort of personality-wise and temperament-wise, someone who doesn't suffer fools, doesn't like dumb, what he might view as dumb questions, and is also in an odd way really, really humble about some of the things that he does, which is why in Vegas it struck me that he didn't talk about a lot of the work that he had done on things that Democrats care about. He was much better in the debate last night in Charleston. I think he was able to get a lot of his points across, especially in the clip that you ran. I think that what he's doing in this campaign, we can't forget that, yes, he's running for president, but at the same time, he has set up a sort of mirror campaign, which will stay up and running even if he's not the Democratic nominee, because for him, ensuring that President Trump is a one-term president is the ultimate goal. And so whether he's the nominee or not, that's what he's doing. Now,
let me jump in, and I need to move to clips of other candidates for time. But did you see that there was even a commercial break in the debate in which a Bloomberg commercial aired? How could CBS even allow that?
Well, there was a Bloomberg commercial that aired. There was a Sanders commercial that aired. Yeah, there were other, which I thought was very unusual as well. I'd never seen that before. But I did see other campaign commercials. Okay. So that is highly unusual.
Bernie Sanders had to answer for his comment on 60 Minutes on Sunday that Fidel Castro did some good things in Cuba, like healthcare and literacy, even as he was a brutal dictator. Sanders last night offered this historical context.
Occasionally, it might be good idea to be honest about American foreign policy. And that includes the fact that America has overthrown governments all over the world, in Chile, in Guatemala, in Iran. And when dictatorships, whether it is the Chinese or the Cubans do something good, you acknowledge that.
Hi, Mr.
But you don't have trade love letters with them.
So how would you describe the job for Sanders? I mean, people will agree or disagree or like it or not like it. But as a matter of analysis, the job for Sanders in explaining democratic socialism to Americans, when his opponents are trying to tar him with being sympathetic toward totalitarian socialism, and he gives them an opening by being nuanced about Castro.
Yeah, this is something that I think drives the fear among some Democrats on that stage, who are afraid that if he becomes the nominee, he becomes a prime and easy target for President Trump and Republicans up and down the ballot to tie him to totalitarian, anti-American, anti-small-D democratic regimes around the world. The thing that Senator Sanders has going for him is that he's been remarkably consistent. This is the view in that clip that you just played is the view that he has had for decades. And when you've been saying the same thing for decades, you are comfortable in that. And no matter what question comes at you, that is the way you're going to answer. He understands that what he said about Castro in Cuba, it caused him a political problem in now that he is on this presidential stage and is looking for ways to buff and sand and, as you said, make his response a little more nuanced. But in that clip that you played, I kept thinking about President Trump and some of the things he said during the campaign about Russia and Vladimir Putin, right, and how, you know, look, you know, America, you know, we've assassinated people and we've done some not so nice things. So yep, what's the big deal? I mean, that's the similarity there between Senator Sanders and then candidate Trump and now. And now President Trump.
Well, I think, in fairness, Trump says, what's the big deal? I can shrug off what Putin does. Sanders is making a moral case about, agree or disagree, Sanders is making a moral case about things not being black and white and healthcare and literacy and democratic as opposed to authoritarian socialism. But, you know, Trump was like, yeah, I can like Putin because he likes me.
Right. It's that simple.
Here's one of Amy Klobuchar's notable moments from last night, and unfortunately for everyone involved, it came after an embarrassing moment of cacophonous crosstalk.
Let's talk about it.
Can I say something?
Look, first of all,
Bernie, let me go.
Bernie, I was talking.
I was talking.
All I know is
if we
spend the next 4 months tearing our party apart, we're going to watch Donald Trump spend the next 4 years tearing our country apart.
And I thought, Jonathan, that was moderator failure. Of course they all want to talk and assert themselves. That's one of their jobs in a debate in a crowded field. I thought one of the moderators should have just identified an order in which they were supposed to go there, and instead they were left to give an impression that the Democratic field is tearing each other apart. I'm just curious of what you thought of Klobuchar or that scene.
Yeah, that scene was a mess. And I agree with you. It was moderator failure. I think sometimes the televised debates, especially when there's an audience involved and there's emotional reaction, applause and booing, that feeds into the carnival-like atmosphere, and one that feeds into sort of the infotainment aspect of American politics right now. And, you know, with Senator Klobuchar jumping in and saying what she said, it reminded me of the first debate in June of last year when they were all fighting. And then in the race, Senator Kamala Harris jumped in and said, listen, you know, guys, folks don't want to see a food fight. They want to see how we're going to help them put food on their table. And it was, you know, a centering moment. But now it seems as though the networks have decided that what they want is a visual food fight than to actually have the candidates talk about real issues and have a real conversation. With Senator Klobuchar, that was a great moment for her in a debate where she needed to have a lot of great moments because she's staring at a shelf life that is about to expire. with Super Tuesday coming up 3 days after South Carolina, Minnesota is a part of Super Tuesday, and it's a state that she is all but certain to win. But after that, it is unclear to me where she goes in terms of picking up delegates or even winning states.
And as we begin to run out of time, one addendum to that, at one point Joe Biden caught himself, of all things, actually following the rules for length of answer when he saw the countdown clock while talking about foreign policy.
Prevent North Korea from launching missiles to take them down. And if we don't, why am I stopping? No one else stops.
Okay. Okay, sir.
That's my Catholic school training.
Okay. So.
Vice President Biden, you're a gentleman. Good home training. Thank you, sir.
Gentlemen don't get very well treated up here.
Ouch. Jonathan, a last thought, 30 seconds.
Yeah, with Vice President Biden, I think in all of these debates, people kept talking about how he kept stopping himself, cutting himself off. And one of the knocks against Vice President Biden is that he talks too much, that he goes on and on and on and on. And I think probably in debate prep, they said to him, be mindful of the clock, be mindful of the clock. And he has been that way throughout all of these debates. But yesterday, as you played in that clip, he decided, well, hey, why am I stopping? No one's following the rules. And if that Joe Biden keeps showing up, he could be in this for a very long time.
Jonathan Capehart, Washington Post columnist and editorial board member, host of the Cape Up podcast from the Washington Post, and also sometimes a WNYC host. Thank you so much for joining us from South Carolina today.
Thanks, Brian.
And listeners, we want to invite you in on the conversation, too. If you've got a question about a national news item, whether it's something you want to know about the election or the Trump administration or anything else you think might fall under the national politics umbrella, give us a call and leave us a message with your name, where you're calling from, and your question. We'll collect those and keep them in our pocket for when I'm speaking with someone who can give you a good answer. The number is 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255, 844-745-TALK. See you tomorrow.